Welcome to Words and Pictures, the show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Counser, and today I'm joined by an award-winning journalist and author who's written for The New York Times, Rolling Stone, Vanity Fair, and The Nation. His books include Reading Comics, How Graphic Novels Work and What They Mean, and All of the Marvels, A Journey to the Ends of the Biggest Story Ever Told. Douglas Wolk, welcome to Words and Pictures.
Thank you so much. Good to be here.
Before we get started, I'd like to remind all of our listeners that we are currently in the midst of KBOO's all-important fall membership drive. We hope that you've been enjoying our special programming featuring the theme Sounds of Democracy, and that you'll take a moment to become a member of KBOO. Because we're still being cautious and not yet opening up our studios, we don't have volunteers at the station to take your calls right now, but you can show your support by giving online kboo.fm. or text KBOO to 44321. And we do have a special thank you gift to offer. If you contribute $60 or more during Words and Pictures today, we'd love to thank you with a copy of Douglas's book, All of the Marvels, courtesy of Penguin Press. Be sure to input your address after donating. We'll follow up by email with all eligible donors. KBOO is one of the very last media outlets that still brings you local and independent news, music, and public affairs. We've been doing this here in Portland for over half a century, and this program has been coming to you for nearly 18 years now, inviting important cultural figures into the studio and venturing out to events that might fly beneath the radar of the big media monoliths. So yes, you can support this very special programming today by going online to kboo.fm/give. Or if you like, you can mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214. So, Douglas, your 2008 book, Reading Comics, won a Harvey Award as well as an Eisner Award for Best Comics-Related Book. You are, it seems, one of the experts in the field of comics.
I'm not sure if I go that far, but I did read an awful lot of comics for the new book. I believe 27,000 issues, give or take, a little bit more than that. As I understand, it takes 5,000 issues to turn somebody into flaming carrots. So I'm at about like 5.4 flaming carrots worth of comics overdose.
How long did this project go on, the one that was leading up to All of the Marvels?
So the reading plus the writing together was almost exactly 5 years. I thought it was going to be an easy two and a half year. No. There was a lot of work involved.
Well, let's get a little bit of historical background here about the big two comics publishers, DC and Marvel.
Yes.
In the Western world, at least, they dominate the field. One of the big differences between Marvel and DC is the success that Marvel has had in translating their comic stories into movies and creating this sort of fabric. MCU stands for Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Yeah, I mean, the Marvel story has been going on continuously since 1961. It's 27,000 issues, it's 540,000 pages or whatever. It's one big story. Any part of it can refer to any previous part. Every part of it is supposed to be at least pretty much compatible with every other part. And that's a fascinating thing about it, because this is a story that has been being told for 60 years. It is a story that's so big that not even any of the people telling it have read the whole thing. But it's a story, and it reflects the world around it for the last 60 years. It's this kind of funhouse mirror image of what American culture has been for 60 years, with lots of spandex and punching.
I'm going to read a little introduction to the book here. The 27,000 or so superhero comic books that Marvel Comics has published since 1961 are the longest continuous self-contained work of fiction ever created, over 500,000 pages to date and growing. For someone who lives in our society, having some familiarity with a Marvel story is useful in much the same way as, say, being familiar with the Bible is useful for someone who lives in a Judeo-Christian society. Its iconography and influence are pervasive. That's quite a claim, Mr. Wolk.
It is. Why not make the big claim? Print a legend. But it's true. You cannot go anywhere without seeing images from the Marvel story. You'll see Spider-Man on stuff. You'll see the X-Men on stuff. I think I said something like, 18 of the 100 highest grossing movies ever are based on parts of it. You see the characters on bags of salad greens. You see the characters on t-shirts. There are TV shows. There are movies. Like, it's just everywhere. And there's almost nobody who has read the whole thing.
Right. You said every school child recognizes the Marvel story's protagonists. Spider-Man, the Incredible Hulk, the X-Men. Star Wars and Avatar and The Matrix would be unimaginable without it.
I think that's fair, right? Well, maybe not. Okay. You can argue with me if you like, but I see a lot of Jack Kirby's innovations, of Steve Ditko's innovations, of the stuff that came out especially of Marvel in the 60s and beyond. All that stuff turns up mutated in other bits of popular culture, as other bits of popular culture turn up mutated within the Marvel story, obviously. But it's there. Like, it is, I think the line I use in the book, it's a mountain smack in the middle of culture. It's there. You can ignore it if you want, but it's a mountain. It's right there.
Well, you mentioned the X-Men. So tell us about the X-Men. The X-Men are mutants.
Right.
And a lot of what has developed over the decades has been that Marvel has sort of reflected society back to itself and has championed really underrepresented groups. You know, when you come to characters like the X-Men, there's a lot of metaphorical energy going on here. These are comics that have helped young kids come to terms with who they are when they feel like mutants, when they feel like outcasts.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the brilliant things about X-Men as a metaphor, the metaphor of the mutants, being a mutant could stand in for pretty much any kind of difference you wanted, pretty much any kind of subaltern group you wanted. Is X-Men about race? No, it's not quite. Like, but it can be. Is it about disability? Not literally, not specifically, but you can read it that way. Is it about sexuality? You can absolutely read it that way. It is not specifically, literally so much about that, but it's there. You can map it onto your own experience. And one fantastic thing about X-Men is that it has never denied those readings. It has never pushed away those readings. It has embraced those readings. And the story has attracted readers who can see themselves in it. And gone on and gotten bigger and bigger. It's interesting, like, X-Men fans are not quite like any other kind of fans. X-Men fans are very, very attached to the characters, at least as much as they are attached to the story. Like, I've talked to people who have worked on X-Men comics, and it's a tremendous challenge because you have to do right by every last character of that enormous ensemble series, or the fans are going to be very, very angry.
So you've read 27,000 comics, and you've taken these threads, and you've laid them out in this book for people to get an introduction. In some cases, it's like a Cliff Notes version. In some cases, it's like an introduction, a critique. Like, is this something that I'll like?
The idea behind the book was not to put together a list of, like, these are the 100 comics you must read, or these are the 100 comics that will give you, like, the idea of what these other, 26,900 are about. It was, this is a guided tour. This is a tour around a territory that I have covered all of for people who are curious about what this enormous mountain of stories is like and how they might get into it and what they might find there and what kinds of pleasures and joys and interesting things they might find inside this enormous story.
When you're laying out the book, one of the cautionaries you offer is, you said that Marvel's comics, even at the outset, were not designed to be read in a specific unified order. The edict of the comics business was that every issue is somebody's first. And when a particular issue was off the newsstands, it was gone. And this is what makes people think of 1960s superhero comics as kind of cheesy. Back then, each issue of a comic pretty much assumed that a reader was coming in knowing nothing.
Yeah, very much so. Now it is not nearly like that. There are, for one thing, like there are very often pages at the beginning to kind of explain what the situation is and everything, what everything is before we get into the story. There's also the internet. But one of the beautiful things about comics as a culture, comics as a social medium, because they are, there are people who have read these things and love to help out. If you pick up a story and you're coming in and like, it's an engaging story, it's an interesting story, you're enjoying reading it, but it keeps mentioning things that you're not sure who they are, what they are, like, why does that planet have a goatee? Why is Hercules doing that? What's going on here? That's a feature, not a bug. That is, well, there's some history here. This is a story that's been going on for 60 or 80 years, and there's some stuff that happened before, and you don't really need to know what that is to enjoy the story, if it's a good story. What you can do is take note of what you don't know and what you want to know, because there's probably a way to find that out later on. Find what you're curious about. Look it up. That's what the internet is for. That's kind of the fun of it.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And we're talking today with Douglas Wolk. He's the author of Reading Comics and All of the Marvels. Now, on a personal note, when I came into reading comics, it was during the 1970s, and there were a lot of interesting cultural crossovers happening. There was Kung Fu, there was Afrofuturism, there was psychedelia. I mean, when you look at comics like Doctor Strange or Howard the Duck, you have to really wonder, like some of these writers and artists, how they were expanding their consciousness.
Great. Absolutely. You know, there's always been, even in the most commercial side of comics, and let's face it, Marvel Comics is the most commercial end of this medium. It is, their decisions are driven at every turn by what's going to make money. But sometimes what's artistically adventurous, what is breaking new ground, is the same thing as what's going to make money. That's a lovely thing. Of course, also in the 1970s, there was not a lot of money in this. Nobody thought like, oh, there's going to be movies that are making hundreds of millions of dollars. No. It was, comics were a thing to do because you loved comics and really not so much for any other reason. But there were some extraordinarily talented, interesting creators who were involved then, as there are extraordinarily interesting out there creators who are doing stuff now. I mean, if you look at the stuff that Daniel Warren Johnston is doing right now on Beta Ray Bill, like that is as far out a comic as Marvel has ever published visually. There's fantastically interesting stuff happening basically every month out at the fringes, and even the mainstream has its fringes. I kind of love that.
Well, you've dedicated an entire chapter of the book to Stan Lee, Jack Kirby, and Steve Ditko. I mean, three of the people that were there right at the start with Marvel. Well, you know, when people talk about Marvel, Stan Lee tends to be the first name that comes up. He was a writer from the early days before becoming publisher, and he was a genius at promotion. Some would say self-promotion.
Oh, yeah. He was absolutely a genius at self-promotion. The thing is, he promoted everybody who collaborated with him. There's, you know, a very early issue of Tales of Suspense with Iron Man story in it, and it blazes like right at the top of the cover. It's like Lee, Heck, and Ditko have come up with another masterpiece, and you know, Stan Lee's name is front and center, but so is Steve Ditko's name, and so is Don Heck's name. He wanted to drag everybody into the spotlight with him. Stan Lee is fascinating. Like, I feel like there's the sort of like Earth brain, solar system brain, galaxy brain. The Earth brain is like, Stan Lee is a genius who created everything at Marvel. Solar System Brain is Stanley is a charlatan who just stole credit for everybody else's work and didn't do anything. And Galaxy Brain is Stanley is actually a genius editor. He is a genius editor. He's a fantastically good writer. The only character that he ever created by himself was Stan Lee. But, you know, Stan Lee is a character. He is a persona. He's the fantastic thing that John Romita once called him. He said, Stan was a con man. Everybody knows that, but he did deliver. That's Stan Lee, the con man who delivers the goods. He's obviously going to rip you off. He's obviously going to cheat you. And he still comes through.
So you talk a lot about Jack Kirby. And Jack Kirby, of course, was hugely influential. And he was also a big reader of classic mythology. He would swipe characters from sagas and epics and centuries-old literature. I mean, Thor came straight out of the Norse pantheon, for example.
He did. Like, everybody in Thor, in the Thor comic, was straight out of the Norse pantheon. You would also see the Greek pantheon turning up. You know, Hercules shows up. Eventually, I think it was established that within the Marvel Universe, every body of mythology is just something interesting that actually happened at some point that somebody happened to write down, which is, you know, kind of lovely to think about.
Yeah, lots of creators do that kind of swiping nowadays. You have Shakespearean riffs set in the present day. You have updated Victorian and Regency romances, things like that, in the movies and in books, literature.
Yeah, I mean, one of the lovely things about the Marvel Universe as it worked out is that it took all of that stuff that they'd been publishing early on, the monster comics and the westerns and the science fiction comics and the romance comics and the teen humor comics and all of this stuff that this very small stable of writers and artists had been working on. And when superhero stuff caught on, they poured all of that into it. The Fantastic Four is a monster comic that's also a romance comic and is also an adventure comic, like, you know, Challengers of the Unknown, which is a previous Kirby project. And, you know, it's also a science fiction comic, and it's also kind of a horror comic. And the Hulk, which was the next thing that was their big superhero title, was not really a superhero title. It's a monster comic with a recurring protagonist. And it doesn't take on that, like, villain of the month, adventure of the month tone for a little while after that. Spider-Man first appears in Amazing Fantasy, which has just changed its name from Amazing Adult Fantasy at that point for its final issue. The first Spider-Man story is an 11-page story. It's obviously supposed to be part of this science fiction horror anthology. And it's, you know, its very first panel is like, well, do you like superhero stories? We in the biz refer to them as long underwear types. And it's about a kid who gets bitten by a bug and ruins his life. And at the end of the first superhero story about Spider-Man, he is walking into the distance, sobbing his eyes out at his failure. That is not how superhero stories started in those days. It's kind of still not. It's amazing.
How has Marvel done, in your opinion, when it comes to representation, gender, cultural diversity? You know, there's projects such as Spider-Man, Into the Spider-Verse. And yeah, there's plenty of controversy. There's older readers who are having problems with the morphing of certain characters that's been going on recently.
Those particular older readers, you know what? I'm 51 years old. I'm a white male cis hetero dude. If I never see another comic about a character who's just like me ever again, I'm still set for life. The supply is inexhaustible. I've tried. It's inexhaustible. There's more than enough to go around. I am so happy to see more characters and more creators who are not just pretty much like me. I mean, the center of old Marvel, 60s, 70s, was a cluster of mostly white, mostly guys, the same 15 people. And it's way past time for things to expand beyond that.
in the talent pool that Marvel had, you had people who were way ahead of their time, like Steve Ditko, who you mentioned earlier. The stuff he did on his own, I mean, that was like alternative underground comics before alternative and underground comics.
Yeah, you know, there were always ties between the underground and mainstream Marvel. Flo Steinberg, who was one of the original people who was in the Marvel office all the way, was also somebody who had a lot of ties to the underground comic scene in New York, and she actually published her own title, Big Apple Comics. Françoise Mouly, who was the co-editor of Raw magazine with Art Spiegelman and is now the cover editor of New Yorker, she was a Marvel colorist for a few years in there. You can see there are some old, you know, issues of Daredevil and Marvel Team-Up and stuff that she colored. And now, especially, there's this conversation between what we think of as this is a mainstream thing that sells a whole lot of copies, and this is a crazy arty thing, and you know what, this is so outsidery. And it's really, they're not so far apart as you might think. There's the influence runs all kinds of directions.
So Douglas, let's talk about reading comics, how graphic novels work and what they mean. This is the book that won you a Harvey Award and an Eisner Award back in 2008. You took a very broad look at comics in this earlier book. You went beyond the mainstream to really spotlight individual storytellers and show how their work related to other art forms.
Yeah, I mean, this was a book that I wrote 14 years ago, and it was partly pieced together from some pieces I'd published other places. I just really wanted to talk about comics in an aestheticizing kind of way. Comics as an art form that was distinct in itself. I started writing about comics by accident. I was working as a music journalist. I was editing a music magazine. We had some pages to fill. The editor was like, oh, you know, Douglas, you like comics. You want to do a couple comics reviews? Sure, I'll do that. And all of a sudden, that became a thing I did, and then a thing I did more of, and then a thing that people wanted to give me money to do. And I'm cool with that. I have the best job in the world. I get to read comics all day and then talk about them. So much fun.
That's right. You started out as a pop music critic, as far as your livelihood went.
Indeed.
You were the managing editor for CMJ, New Music Monthly.
I was.
And you wrote a book about the seminal 1963 album by James Brown, Live at the Apollo.
Mm-hmm. I actually just gave a talk about that book a couple of weeks ago, which is odd because it's a book I wrote 17 years ago. Like, getting called on to talk for an hour about a thing you did 17 years ago is not a thing that happens very often. But I love that album. And again, that is a piece of art that reflects its historical moment in a really, really strong way. It was recorded on October 24th, 1962 in New York City, which is smack in the middle of the Cuban Missile Crisis. So it was an audience of people who thought there was a pretty good chance they would be dead inside the week. And it's a tense record. It is an album about tension and releasing tension, and it's a history of Black American music up to that point. And it's James Brown, who was not just larger than life, but larger than any 15 lives he cared to name. Yeah, so it was a lot of fun to write that, and a lot of fun to go back to it and talk about it and show some movies, play some pictures, get to show people some footage of James Brown dancing in the early 60s. It was great stuff.
So you have accomplished these mammoth projects and completed them, unlike so many who take on huge projects and never quite complete them. So what's next for you?
That is a fine question. I'm going to be touring for all the Marvels for the next couple of months. I'm doing a lot of physical events. I'm doing a lot of virtual events. I'm going to be traveling around California for the first 2 weeks of November. And then coming back just in time for the Portland Book Festival, where I get interviewed on stage by Kelly Sue DeConnick, I get to announce as of today, which I am so excited about because Kelly Sue is amazing. Then I'm teaching comics history at Portland State this term. I may be doing a little more teaching here and there. I have a couple of ideas for a book-ish kind of projects in mind, which mostly don't have anything to do with comics or have very, very little to do with comics. I love them. I might need a little bit of a break from writing about them. On the other hand, you know, the right thing comes up. I would love to write more comics. I have done a bit of that. I wrote a Judge Dredd miniseries a few years ago that was really one of the most fun things I've ever gotten to do, collaborating with the artist Ulysses Farinas, who's absolutely genius. I would love to do some more of that. I would love to do some more interesting, unexpected, creative stuff. But yeah, I don't know what's next.
Well, you've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. And we've been talking today with Douglas Woke, journalist, critic, and author of Reading Comics and All of the Marvels. Douglas, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Conch. This is great.
And for those listeners who might be interested in finding out more about your work, where would they look?
You can look at douglaswolk.com, which is my main site. I also have a weekly podcast called The Voice of Latveria, which is at voiceoflatveria.com, which purports to be a propaganda news broadcast from the Cold War era Eastern European state of Latveria, the Dr. Doom rules.
Well, we hope you've been enjoying our special Sounds of Democracy program for KBOO's fall membership drive. Before we go, I'd like to remind all of our listeners that this community radio station needs your support, as our physical studios are remaining closed for the time being. To become a member of KBOO or to arrange for a donation of any size, please visit kboo.fm/give. You can also text KBOO to 44321. Or if you prefer, you can mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland, 97214.
And we do have a special thank you gift to offer. If you contribute $60 or more during Words and Pictures today, we'd love to thank you with a copy of Douglas's book, All of the Marvels, courtesy of Penguin Press. Be sure to input your address after donating. We'll follow up by email with all eligible donors.
Thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. You can find an archived version of this show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on Twitter @WordsAndPicture.